This is the Juggle Podcast. If you want a satisfying career and a fulfilling family life, this is the podcast for you.
Join me, Jo Alilovich,
and me, Lucy Dickens,
as we share strategies and insights to help you keep your balls in the air. Good morning, everyone. Hi, I'm Jo Alilovich.
I'm Lucy Dickens. Welcome back to the Juggle Podcast.
Today, we are very fortunate to have with us a guest, Dean Brayovich, who is currently the General Manager of Human Resources at Monadelphous Group. The Monadelphous Group is a leading Australian engineering group providing construction, maintenance and industrial services to the resources, energy and infrastructure sectors. It employs about 6,000 people throughout Australia and in neighbouring countries. Dean's now a single dad of four, juggling the demands of a high-powered career and a family. And as a result of his work and personal experiences, he's keen to foster an environment where people can be effective but still participate in a full life. Thanks for joining us, Dean.
Thanks.
Dean's going to talk to us today about how he manages his busy career and his family life as a single dad of four. He's going to share some of the initiatives implemented by Monadelphous to support working parents, how he leads by example and encourages others to do the same, and also how it's important to recognise that when it comes to the work and family juggle, there's no one size that fits all.
So are you ready for this, Dean?
Don't know. I mean, I had to sort of, you know, just collect my thoughts a little bit.
Have you got some notes there?
I do. You're not going to see them. They'll be smacking. I've got our diversity and gender diversity inclusion plan at my fingertips, and I've got all this. It's very topical for us at the moment, particularly because our gender D&I plan is our first consolidated gender D&I plan that's about to be launched. Now, we've put a lot of time, effort and energy into, rather than, you know, previously it lived in a corporate governance statement that was part of our corporate reporting from an annual report and all the rest of it, and it got sort of consolidated at particular times of the year. It got focused, but more of on a piecemeal basis, whereas it's been a tough piece of work to get to this point, probably 2 years, and in a consolidated way that has structure, clear commitments, clear targets, and it's part of by putting focus on it, we can say, well, we're here now, where do we want to be in a measured way without, it's one of these areas, a broad range of opinions in terms of where you should sit and what we should do. And, you know, we've got clients like BHP with, you know, 50-50, you know, like, which is great and all the rest of it. But all of that, of course, as a key contracting partner, gets pushed down to us. And we're part of this, and it has a focus, but it also has a clear, direct commercial connection at the same time. So using that as, you know, rightly, wrongly, and differently, just using that as a launching point to put further focus and effort behind it. And I think it's starting to get that traction. So, yeah, very topical for us.
It's a very topical thing. It's so great to be able to talk to a man about this sort of stuff as well.
Yes. You're our first male guest. We're really excited.
Yeah, pressure's on now.
We were at the Australian Oil and Gas Conference the week before last, and they have a diversity breakfast each year, and we had a table of 10, and we were front, you know, it was 35 tables, so 350 people there. Mike Usler, the CIO from Woodside, was the MC. You know, a lot of really fantastic speakers. And he stopped the thing about halfway through and he goes, I just want to draw everyone's attention to table 14. And that was our table. And he goes, can table 14 stand up? And we're all like, no, we don't want. And because when we came in, our oil and gas GM that organized it goes, we're all, go have a look, we're all guys. There's 10 of us. And I said, no, Doug, this is exactly what we need. This is exactly the sort of, you know, you go to these things and it's always highlighted, need more men at them. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so not half an hour later, Mike goes, hey, can table 14? And really, we're like, not a chance. And we're sort of reluctant. And he goes, big round of applause, group of guys. But still, even now, some of the, you know, they're not sure whether we're being named and shamed, or even though it was quite a raucous applause, it was just still that awkwardness of, are we doing the right thing or not, you know, in that context. Yeah, I'm not sure. I think we were, but I'm not sure.
It is awkward. There's so much stuff now about manuals. Have you heard of those? So a manual is an all-male panel. You go to a lot of events, and it is the fact that there are more men at significant high-level positions than there are women. So when it comes to looking for high-powered, high-level speakers, there's usually more men to choose from than there are women. So there tends to be more men naturally who are getting the gigs. So there's now this backlash on this saying, look, we don't want more mannels. We want to see some diversity on our panels and there needs to be women. So I completely understand why you would feel that. On the one hand, they talk about there needing to be more men. And then there's other women who are saying, oh, yes, but the men get all these rounds of applause because they're a man and they're there. But, you know, there's all these women there and they're not getting rounds of applause for being there either. So it's very difficult. It's one of those situations where you can't win. And all you have to do, I think, is be comfortable with your own internal feelings about why you're there.
Yeah. I thought you said a mammal, and I thought, yeah, I know what that is. I'm that sometimes, but a mammal, that's an but it's like, yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, the Woman in Resources Award goes to, and it's a dude, you know, it's the CEO, like a male CEO, and this award and that award. And it sometimes provides a tiny bit of tarnish if from a cynical perspective, and it can detract from the good that's actually happening, which is a shame. But I suppose, you know, part of these discussions, this dialogue, and this is awareness and consciousness about these things. So you start incrementally, opens your eyes a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, and then you realise, well, does the CEO is it that like the male CEO, is that the appropriate person to provide that award? Maybe it should be to your great development opportunity for a female in the business, just as a you know, without becoming tokenistic, you can look at things in a different way and tailor it rather than just follow that same old path and almost reinforce the stereotype.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that there's always going to be someone taking the negative view about it, and you pretty much can't take a step forward in any of this if you're constantly worried about how it's going to be perceived.
Yeah.
As a single dad of four, and I don't think anyone would dispute the fact that you've got a high-powered career, what are you using? What strategies are you using to manage those two things?
You've got to be organised. I've got a diary that sets out my year in advance, in terms of who's where, when. I've got independent, you know, it's my kids range from Millie's 8 and my eldest Seb's just about 17. And so there's, you know, I'm 15 and a 10-year-old. So primary school and high school, and the high school, the high school's the other side of the city as well, which wasn't a good decision. Being highly organised and letting people know that's just the way it is. It impacts travel. I have to do a lot of interstate and international travel. I've got to be, you know, very upfront with what I can and can't do without making it. That's my issue. It's not anyone else's. You know, I've got to be in the moment. You know, you're either at work and efficient and effective with your kids, and then if you have to do, you know, something afterwards. So you break it down. It's not just a blur of one thing into the other. I mean, this morning, for instance, with monthly, you know, performance management meetings, all of our GM team, I couldn't get there till 9. So it starts at 8:30. It's a regular occurrence. Doesn't always, you know, the cycle's not always like that. But, you know, you just indicate, might be the agenda's up front, but they just change it and they know why. And you don't make an excuse or call in 10 minutes before and say you're running late. You tell them 2 days beforehand. And it's just part of how you organise things.
So you're very upfront with everyone at work about your family, and you don't try to hide those family commitments, which quite often people do. They, like you say, make excuses or call in late, whatever it might be.
And I'm not doing it for any other reason than like being highly pragmatic, and that's necessary. And I'm very fortunate, you know, in the role that I am, that I suppose it's not just someone's going to say, well, hey, that isn't good enough or whatever it might be. But you've still got to deliver, and that's, you know, to marry up the two.
Yeah. And I'd say that's probably because it is good enough, because you might not get there till 9, but like you say, you're working in the evenings once your kids go to bed and you balance it out, and maybe it's not a traditional 9 to 5, but you're still fulfilling your role.
That's right. You see it a lot. You know, I've got a large direct team, and, you know, you see that transition from someone, and I'm thinking of Express people that I've seen grow up here in my team, that they transition, particularly with their first child, and, you know, it's from zero to everything in a very short period of time. And
yes,
and when they return, I've seen it being that real shock to, okay, I'm now working 2 to 3 to 4 days a week or whatever it might be, and it's a change of mindset as to how you remain effective, but as well just that sense of adding value and all the rest of it. Like, because of the nature of the role, I think it's more the latter than the former. I think you've got to be available. I mean, it's difficult to turn off. You've got to be very aware of that. I think that you know, you're not sitting down with your kids having, you know, watching TV or having dinner or whatever it is, and, you know, you've got one eye on TV, one eye on your mobile phone, and you're ignoring what they're saying. I think you've that notion of being in the moment and doing whatever it is you're doing at that point in time with as much as you can, your full attention. So I think it is more the latter, as you say, but certainly aware of the former with people around me. And I think that's horses for courses. Coming back to that overtness around your circumstance, I mean, someone working 3 days a week, I think it's critical it's in their email signature block that they're, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So not continually getting calls and things on the Monday and the Friday, for argument's sake. But often that takes a bit of convincing for someone to do that. They feel like they're doing something that's wrong, and it's not. It's just, that's what it is. I don't put, you know, like, just that's what it is.
And that's the other thing about email as well. People expect an instant response, which I think is just wrong, because email's not meant for instant communication. You know, you're allowed a day or two to reply to somebody.
That's right. Sometimes the response is far better.
Do you think that you get treated differently to some of the working mums that you come across?
I don't feel I've ever been questioned around some, you know, 3 days a week I'll have a 9 o'clock start for it. So I've never been questioned around that. Mm. Whereas it wouldn't be a big leap to sort of anticipate that maybe others would in different roles. So look, generally speaking, I think I'd agree with that proposition, but certainly I feel in my role incumbent upon me, both in a, you know, within my direct team, and I've got that direct line, you know, responsibility and accountability as their general manager to, if I see or feel or the right culture and behaviours not being exhibited, to step in, as well as being part of the executive here at Monos to set the scene and, you know, dial in how we want to be from a cultural perspective that encompasses all of these sorts of factors. So, but yeah, coming back to it, I'd be difficult to disagree.
I didn't necessarily think of it as only a negative, in that, you know, you would be treated more favourably than other working mums. I also think that there's the possibility that people would respect it and, you know, kind of look at the working dad who's actually taking the time to work more flexibly and to spend that time with their children, whereas what we tend to experience most often in our society is the dad just doing the I was going to say the 9 to 5, but it's more like the 7 to 6. And, you know, possibly making it home in time for dinner and a bath at night. So, you know, I think that you presenting that image could be a very positive in the organisation that you work for the other men and for everyone.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think there's others that do it as well. I'm not going to, you know, there's some great people around me that model some pretty, you know, some really good behaviours and, you know, feel quite blessed to be an organisation. You know, I'm going to sell the Monos. I think we're a fantastic organisation that really does allow people to grow and, you know, grow all aspects of their life. And again, you know, to me saying it, you know, you'd ask others, maybe they have different views, but I think this is a pretty cool spot. It's a pretty special spot for that. And you know, I can think of, you know, immediate examples with my team and broadly where people are doing not dissimilar things. So hopefully it's seen as a nothing, just is what it is, and it's normal, mm-hmm. It's natural, and hopefully that's the case.
And clearly part of the leadership team, I mean, you head up the HR department. How would you say that your personal experiences have helped shape how Monadelphous now deal with flexibility? How have you taken your personal story and then used that to shape what they do there?
I said everyone's different, and I don't mean that in a you know, like, I just mean that in a really simplistic way. Everyone's got a different set of circumstances. You know, everyone's balancing something. Everyone's, be that, you know, their footy training versus their 20 cats or their, you know, whatever. Everyone's got their thing. And that's what I certainly try and engender in every, you know, the influence that I bring to the table here. And in this particular, from a family balancing perspective, I've got a really conscious approach around this that I continue to use, and that is I've got nearly 200 people within my broader group HR team. I use them as guinea pigs in a positive way.
As long as they know, it's okay, right?
You know, in terms of introducing, like 6 months ago, you know, trying to stand up a broader-based mentoring program, externally facilitated mentoring program for women in the business.
Is that the Rare Birds program, Dean?
Exactly. And I thought, well, look, I can draft lots of business cases, you know, run through lots of PowerPoints and all the rest and talk about how good it could be. Or I could just kick it off within, you know, I selected 13 people within my team who are probably people that generally speaking wouldn't be involved. You know, they'd be a layer or two below who would naturally be considered for mentoring, and it brought them together. Said, hey, you know, didn't overcomplicate. Said, oh, you know, this is something I think would be great for the broader monos. I think we should try it ourselves. You guys are both, I want to hear in terms of how it works for rolling it out more broadly, as well as for you personally, like, you know, weigh that up, how you see fit, and test it for, it's a 12-month program, test it for 3 or 4 months, and if it's something that we like, then we roll it out, you know, we propose to roll it out more broadly, but on the back of tried and tested experience. And that's the sort of thing I try and do on all of these sorts of initiatives, you know, rather than try and influence a big, broad, massive people, influence what I can in a really direct way, and then just build on that from time to time. And I certainly look to do that from, I mentioned the launch of our gender diversity and inclusion plan. A lot of the initiatives and activities within that, it's taken 2 years to get to a point of a quite a formalised, but proud of the document itself. But a lot of initiatives and things in there, like the Rare Birds one in particular, been deliberately dropping these breadcrumbs along the way and then just collecting them all together and saying, hey, this is what we're doing. And then we can do more on the back of that, as opposed to spending those 2 years trying to run around, cajole, advocate, use whatever diplomacy I may have to get to a point where all of a sudden you're starting. You know, we've already come a long way.
What I'm hearing is that there's a lot of continuous improvement going on with diversity and everything in the workplace and allowing different options for people. So what's Monadelphous currently got in place when it comes to its policies and procedures and all those formal things to make sure that parents and others are being accommodated and encouraged when it comes to flexibility?
Organisationally, we've got a standard suite of procedures when it comes to, you know, the thou shan't ones in terms of, you know, your EEO and any harassment, bullying, those sorts of things, through to our, you know, ones that contain more of the what you can do and what you can ask for. Look, I don't think they're earth-shattering. What they certainly don't do is get in the way of flexibility and get in the way of empowerment of managers and the rest. So they're not prescriptive. I think they're enabling documents. So therefore, it's important on the back of this to then, we'll make sure that people with line manager responsibilities and all the rest of it are therefore expressly empowered to exercise, to respond in a positive way to requests for flexibility, to requests for early starts, late starts, early finishes and the like.
So how are you managing that? How are you managing to empower those line managers when in so many organisations that kind of stuff is just HR department, sorry, we don't know how to deal with that, go and talk to somebody else?
I think it's a HR department that hopefully doesn't do that. It's one that, and I think it runs through our culture. It runs through, you know, you just look around and, you know, there's examples of people that do have, as I say, you know, late starts, early finishes, you know, people are coming in. Our recruitment team's a great example. And about 12 months ago, we recognised, I mean, from a recruitment perspective, most of the calls and prospective candidates happen after hours on weekends and all the rest of it. So, and people were doing extensive hours, weekend work. So then we implemented an 8 and 6 roster. So 10-hour days, compressed, you know, well, 8 on, 6 off. And it had a twofold effect. We had people jumping up and down to get on those rosters, absolutely suited some down to a T. But equally so, for those that weren't on the rosters, what it meant is they had the predictability during their work day that they didn't, you know, they could go home when their day finishes. They didn't, you know, their weekends weren't cluttered with emergent work because there was some structure in place. So
you added structure as opposed to adding flexibility to stop people working so much by the sounds of it.
Absolutely, and rewarded. There was a slight increase. And at the end of the day, we're in business to make money. Unapologetically, you know, the more successful we are, the more stable we can be, the more we can offer our employees in you know, from the very basics, from a rent perspective, as well as other things. And so, it's important to align any of these sorts of flexibilities or non-Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 or 7 to 6 or whatever it might be, in a way that dovetails to our overarching aim of making money. So if it makes sense, it just happens. It happens as a matter of course. But then, of course, it works well when people are, you know, it's a trusting, open environment that people are actually saying what they mean. Now, I think that the three of us probably, you know, have many, many experiences as practitioners where you only find out what people really meant to have said once it all gets broken. It's in a third-party environment. You're reading affidavits and pleading as to what they actually wanted to say. So I think that can be the weakness of that environment, because it does work best when there's openness and transparency and trust and all the rest of it. And you can't always, for various reasons, you don't always get that.
You've mentioned already some of the ways that people are doing it at Monadelphous: early starts, late finishes, 8 to 6. I think that's, you know, really innovative in a traditional corporate kind of environment. Is there anything else that people are doing that stands out in your mind?
You know, there's the shortened days, that sort of thing. Like, you know, someone doing 3 days work over 5 days, those sorts of arrangements, like school out, you know, those arrangements are not en masse. They're horses for courses. We benefit from the time differences between our other corporate offices in Brisbane, and, you know, with the time differences, you can sort of get some, you need the Brizzy, you know, start of the day in Brisbane, the end of the day in Perth. So it does enable, with a bit of imagination and a bit of cooperation, some flexible arrangements.
And what advantages have you seen in the workplace as a result of these kinds of initiatives?
I just think you have people that enjoy their job and therefore have a positive impact around them. They good retention, high productivity, all of those sorts of things. Just that general malaise about that sometimes, you know, without naming workplaces, sometimes experience, you know, it's that I'm here, they pay okay, but, you know, it'd be somewhere else I would. So, look, I think the benefits are those really just fundamental ones. You know, people like being at work. Look, I think it's one of those ones you can always do more. It's a dynamic environment, and that's, well, I think it's so important to keep that open mind and look at everything on its merits. It's not a case of, you know, this job must be done in 3 days or full time. Or I think job shares the most. I've worked at a couple of organisations before this. I had some absolutely fantastic colleagues in the legal environment that job shared. I remember, I won't name that, but it just works so well. And obviously, as a pair, they it suited them. They worked well together and all the rest of it. And sometimes you hear the word job share and people almost like they've, you know, you've sworn at them. And I think that's some people just haven't seen some of these arrangements work well. Mm-hmm. When it does, it's fantastic. And so I think, and again, I see my role is continually to challenge, well, why can't you do that? Why doesn't it work? You know, why can't, you know, role X, Y, Z be done in a different way? And you've got to drill down and you've got to put pressure. And again, sometimes, you know, those things need to be escalated and ensure that they're escalated quickly. People, you know, get their noses out of joint and, you know, you're not getting that open, trusting relationship.
I just want to tie up a couple of threads because we've moved on a bit from this, but it's still sticking around in my head and I want to ask you. So you've mentioned how you've started to implement small changes so that you don't have to wait for a big revelation, but you can see small little shifts happen along the way. And you've also spoken about your policies and your gender and diversity plan and those kinds of things. What I'm interested in is how they work together. How important is it, do you think, that people have a written policy in terms of these flexibility, gender diversity, and how does that relate in your experience to the practical aspect?
Great question. I think the senior leaders of organisations are responsible for setting the environment within which a desired culture can grow and come to life. And I mean that from a positive sense, and it'll happen from a negative sense if you're not careful as well. So that environment, leaders can't create a culture by wagging their finger at people and saying, you know, you'll be happy, you'll love this place and all the rest of it.
It was so easy.
So I see the policies and procedures and all that within that paradigm. That's that environment. It's not in totality, but they form an important part of shaping that environment. You know, because sometimes words are cheap and people have had experience that have not been great elsewhere or even within these four walls or wherever it might be.
And Dean, people see policies as cheap too, don't they?
Absolutely, but they do provide at least something that's immutable in some way. They can provide some comfort when all things are lost. And I just relating my experience here, it's not often we have to pick up a policy. I remember, again, previous lives, you know, you knew every word of every policy inside and out because they'll continue being quoted. And it's not the best culture. Whereas I think it's necessary, though, because it's framework.
It is framework, yes.
They have to be meaningful. And going too far and too prescriptive, I think some managers can hide behind it. So it's getting that balance right. But I do believe that there needs to be that framework. There needs to be that structure because every now and again, leaders need to put their money where their mouth is. You can't continually talk about flexibilities and supporting this, that, and the other thing and then be afraid of committing to that in some way, in a way that you can be measured against.
That's a good point, Dean, that you need to be able to measure. So how does Monadelphous measure the success of what it's doing?
We've got some key people metrics around, you know, the basic stuff in terms of turnover, retention, and we've got some flags in terms of, you know, what we call here from a key talent perspective, probably not dissimilar to other organisations and a broader population. And then we look at performance planning metrics around these sorts of things. And there's a range of other bits and pieces, but not too exciting. We'll talk here because that's what we're talking about from a gender perspective. We look at, there's some metrics around increasing the percentage of gender participation within our workplace more generally. We're an organisation that reports from a workplace gender equity agency perspective. So, you know, we at least measure that formally every year. But I said it's more of a compliance thing than a real holding us to account because I don't think it really does. But we've got some metrics around, there's no set target, just to be clear, but in terms of increasing our gender participation, we look at that split down in, so there's no point increasing our participation, but all in casual site-based admin roles for argument's sake, it's, you know, it needs to be throughout.
It's across all levels.
Correct. We've set some targets around, and actual hard targets around our vacation program for undergraduates. So we're looking to take 20% female vacation students, and mindful that from an engineering perspective, universities only produce 15% of their graduates are female. So
wow,
pretty hard for that. 20% of our graduates, our target is for females. We've got targets around school-based touch points to talk about STEM pathways and the like. And again, this is all in our plan. We've got metrics around, this comes back into my role, reviewing performance plans of all females above a certain job level. So there's some quantitative and some qualitative metrics around these things. But of course, measuring and doing something about it can be two different things. So the challenge is, well, okay, what are we going to do? If we see something, you know, we do a REM audit twice a year, and it's around, okay, it says whatever it says, making sure we understand what it says and what does it mean and what do we need to do about these sorts of things. There's no point measuring, and if it's a 6 or a 20 and it doesn't mean anything, or there's no point measuring it. So it is incumbent to act when action's required.
And that makes me think, how quick are you at kind of saying it didn't work? For example, if you try a new initiative, you've already mentioned a couple of new things.
Yeah, look, you know, that whole business thing, you need to fail fast and learn and then try again. Can I talk about inspiring rare birds thing? I mean, yeah. hasn't hit the mark with everyone.
Right.
You know, it's some of the participants it can be challenging and confronting. All of a sudden you're talking about yourself, your career path, all these sorts of things.
Just summarise the Rare Birds program for us. You mentioned it's about mentoring, but tell us a bit more about what it involves.
So it's an externally facilitated mentoring program that has a particular focus on females. The founder is a lady by the name of Jo Burston, and is a, you know, acclaimed business leader and an entrepreneur. And so what we've offered it to is a group of early emerging leaders. So they're at a fairly early stage of their career.
Brilliant.
And some of the targets around our graduate targets, our VAC student targets, as well as we're offering cadetships for female graduates. So this is going to be challenging for us. You know, it's quite a competitive market. And then when you put a figure in a document that is widely publicised, at least internally, you know, we need to deliver. So, yeah, I think we've got a few challenges ahead, and hopefully we don't fail.
Well, as you said, if you're going to fail, just do it quickly and move on.
We move on. I think the thing is that, look, I see the real challenges in this space is not what we're doing, is notions about from about what we should be doing. And people have, some rightly so, some really strong views in this area, and it's trying to manage expectations. And, you know, for some people, like, you know, I mean, our focus is unapologetically on the talent pools, the pathways into our competency around engineering. Now, that's not going to float everyone's boat. It'll be like, well, what about this? What about that? So that's where I see that there's potential, I'll just call it, you know, failings in what we're doing. I just see.
But it's other people's views, isn't it? You have to know yourself or your company, and you know your own values, and you just have to back yourself when you make those calls. And I mean, it's easier said than done, but to some extent, it doesn't really matter if other people have different expectations, as long as you're confident that what you've done is right for your business.
Yeah, and I hope it plays out that way. I'm just very, very conscious of being a man in a senior role in a large business that is sitting in a chair drafting these things for someone that's not me. and it's so, so important. I've got a fantastic network of people around me that I can say, okay, look, does this make sense? Is you know, am I barking up the wrong tree? You know, it impacts me professionally because of my role and all the rest of it. But, you know, if it impacts me that way, you know, maybe I do a crap job, but it's impacting people directly in their lives and their livelihood and their profession and all the rest of it.
Listening to you, Dean, I think if there has to be a man sitting in that seat writing those documents and impacting others, I think
you're the right man for the job. Yeah.
There you go. So we're going to ask you a couple of questions to finish up. And one of our favorite ones is always asking people what words do they live by and whether or not you have a personal mantra for your life.
I like the original Star Wars, but I'm always saying, like, you just got to Yoda it, you know, do it or don't do it. Don't try. Just like continually, it's like just Yoda it.
What's one piece of advice that you would give to professionals who are managing the juggle with their family and their career?
I think it's about being in the moment. You know, you can't do three things at once. You can't be three places at once. And that's, you know, that's often the reality. So make a call, and you know, it won't always be the right one. It won't. And you'll find out, and you know, sometimes they'll mean disappointing people, but I'd rather disappoint sometimes someone at work than my kids, you know, and the look on the face of a school event when your daughter, your son finds, you know, locks eyes with you and it's like, you know, they just relax all of a sudden, dad's here or mum's here, whatever it is. And the poor little kid that's looking around and you know, for whatever reason, of course not, you know, but you know, make those choices. Again, you can't always be there, but I think I've learned that sometimes you feel like you've got to make mutually incompatible promises on the same thing. You know, yes, I'll be here and yes, I'll be there. Doesn't work. You've got to say, I'd like to be there, but I can't, well, whatever. But
So make your choice and be comfortable with what you've done and stop the guilt, right?
Yeah, hopefully, yeah.
Easier said than done. It's all overwhelming a lot of the time. So what do you do when you're feeling a bit overwhelmed by it all?
My thinking time's sort of running or cycling or stand-up paddling or something like that. It's something physical that gets a bit, you know, monotonous, but I think that's fairly relaxing in itself. You know, hard to do those things when things do get really, really busy or you feel like you'll be three places at once. But something simple like that, I think at the end of the day, nothing too complex.
Exercise is always a good answer.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Dean. We've really appreciated having this chat with you.
No, my pleasure. Look, I think it's incumbent in these sort of roles that you role model in a way that's consistent with who you are and it's authentic and all the rest of it. And I just think this is an area that, I'm not saying you do it well or anything, but it's highly rewarding. It makes sense. And I don't think it's difficult for anyone. You know, just treat people the way you want to be treated and I think you'll get it right.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dean. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
So that was a great episode and it was really notable because not only did we get some great content, but we had our first male guest on the show.
Hooray, our first male guest.
Hopefully not the last.
Definitely not the last. We definitely want a variety of men and women. There are so many things I can pick out from that interview that I really enjoyed. The one that's standing out the most for me right now is something that Dean said at the very beginning, which was the idea of making small changes now, as opposed to going through a whole process and waiting for somebody to approve a big change, that he's putting in place small pieces of the puzzle that they can look back on and say, we've already started and this is how far we've come.
Yeah, so true. I really liked the fact that he referenced using his own team as guinea pigs. He gets to experiment, which is great, because so often in organizations, especially large corporates, they want to taking it even further when you've got an ASX listing, you know, you've always got so many checks and balances. Whereas in this case, it was like, well, let's not get bogged down in research and making sure that this is the right thing to do. Let's just try it and see if it works. And so often it's a case of just needing to try something, and you can progress so much faster if you're just willing to take a little bit of chance rather than bogging yourself down, waiting to make sure it's absolutely the perfect way to go about something.
Yeah, it's that fail fast concept, but also the recognition that there's not a one size fits all. And so trying with his guinea pigs means that he can see how the policies or the strategies that he implements, how they work with different people.
Yeah, and when you've got a group of 200 or so people, it's definitely not a small sample size. So he's got a lot of benefits there.
Definitely.
Well, I really enjoyed it. I got a lot out of it. And I think Dean came across as he is in real life, which is a great guy who's clearly conscious of the need for change. As we all know, it's really important that everybody's on board with changing things for women in the workplace, particularly people at a senior level, whether they're male or female. So it's great to hear from someone like that.
So that's all from us today. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. It really helps other people find out about our show.
And we would love to know what you thought of Dean's conversation with us today, what you took away from it, what were the big learnings. So please go to our website and leave a comment on the post. The website is www.thejuggle.com.au, and you'll also find links there to our Facebook group if you want to join us and come and join our community and carry on the conversation.
Otherwise, we'll see you next time. Happy juggling.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.